This week on Pop of Culture, multi-talented artist Dan Wright enthralls us with stories from his career.
Also, we look back at how we remember that one job we had during that one summer.
I wrote poems on the order pad I kept tucked in my apron. I liked stepping out into the hot night and bicycling home under the streetlights.
That's in our latest Beautiful Thing.
Coming up.
Support for Pop of Culture comes from the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, and from you. Become a sustaining member of IPR and support local programming today at indianapublicradio.org.
From IPR, this is Pop of Culture. I'm Michelle Kinsey.
And I'm Jen Blackmer.
We're going to start today with Dan Wright. Dan is the cartoonist behind the syndicated comic strip, Wildwood, but his artistic skills really have no bounds. I was thinking about how to describe Dan Wright before this interview. Multi-talented, multifaceted, renaissance man, artistic chameleon, monster artist. But I think we'll just go with Dan.
Oh, that's great.
Is that good?
Yeah, that is good. Michelle, thank you for that. That's pretty fantastic. Thank you. Yeah, and all of those things are right.
Right, yeah. I mean, you do a lot. We have a regular feature here called What Are You Working On? And I was hesitant to ask you that because I thought, we do not have enough time.
No.
Because you are so busy. Creativity is your life.
Well, thanks for that. And that's true. But at the same time, my wife would say, if you would ever just engage, we could have so much more if you would just get off the dime and stop being so lazy and stop indulging yourself every single day. Because the truth is, I have designed my own life so that I can goof off an awful lot, Michelle.
That's pretty nice.
Well, the currency I always have been chasing is not money. It's freedom. Like, I want to goof off. Because I think all right. When I grew up here in Muncie, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm a product of Muncie in many ways. We moved here in 1971 when I was 5. You can do the math. But from an early, early childhood, my dad used to say to me, and he wasn't a man of a lot of advice or things like that, but he said, Danny, you have to spend so much of your time working. Try to do something you enjoy or love. He said, because there's nothing worse than waking up of a morning and dreading what you have to go do. And I took that. I took that advice really seriously. And so we're like, that old Mary Poppins idea of where's the fun inside of this? Because, you know, I've done awful things that, you know, we all hopefully, I think there's some character building inside of doing the things that, like, this part of this really sucks.
Yeah. You learn a lot, put it that way.
Right. So, but having fun at what you're doing, I think is those are the ingredients necessary for somebody to want expertise out of what they're doing. If fun doesn't show up for you, probably you're looking for the exit door rather than for expertise and in digesting that into who you are so it becomes self-expression.
Yeah. Yeah. When did you decide that comedy, art, music was the way you wanted to goof off?
Well, music's always been there for me. It's in the background, really, for me. Like, it's not first language creative. And so I was maybe 4 or 5 years old, and we would drive from Michigan, where I was born just west of Detroit, and we would drive down here to Muncie, where both of my folks were from, and my mom's mom lived here. So we'd come to grandma's house. And I had an uncle who was just old enough to be out of the house, but his bedroom was still intact. And so by the time I was 5, I had George Carlin's albums memorized. Like, I had the 7 dirty words you can't say on TV.
Absolutely.
I knew those, and I knew the timing of those going into kindergarten, and I knew what those words meant. I didn't, and I knew enough to not repeat them to the grown-ups.
Yeah.
But music and comedy and scoring the laugh and getting the laugh, the laughter was a pretty high premium of the currency in my house and in my family's house. And although I can't say that my mom had her funny moments, but my dad appreciated especially musical comedy that had virtuosity built into it, like Homer and Jethro and things like that. So, and he had a record cabinet just full of those things, and I was allowed to listen to all of it. So the connection to the visual arts and music kind of happened for me in the same moment of this same uncle who, you know, in WERK used to be out there on Old Three. Well, they used to run contests, you know, write a poem for your mom on Mother's Day. And if you win, we'll send your mom flowers on Mother's Day. Or the one that became the family legend was draw what you think the woolly bully looks like. And he won all the contests. So we came home on this, and I had to have been four or five because we hadn't moved to Muncie yet. And I asked Uncle Steve, would you please draw what you drew for the Woolly Bully? And that's a song, right?
Yes.
And so he just quickly took a piece of paper down, and the paper went from nothing on it to there stands a realized sort of character. And which it was good. He could draw, and he understood figure drawing. And like, I was hooked by the magic of that. The paper went from blank paper to, that has an actual drawing on it that I am in love with. And I knew right then, oh, I must do that. I must be able to do that. I want that.
Wow.
So I started drawing early. And so music and visual arts really, to me, came at the same time, same moment. And by first grade, the teachers were asking me to make drawings and worksheets for them. And by, upper elementary school, I was winning the poster contests. And the performance bits of it came early. Like, I went to Franklin Middle School.
Yeah.
My eighth grade year, they dressed me up as Kermit the Frog, and I emceed the show. But I also sang in the choir and played in the band. But here I am dressed as Kermit the Frog doing all of that stuff. And in high school, was Snoopy twice in high school, once in my freshman year in You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, and then my senior year as Snoopy in the show called Snoopy. So, and Muncie Civic Theater was an early part of, like, I think my first main stage show was in the seventh grade.
Yeah. And what animal did you play then?
I was a cast member in The Fiddler on the Roof.
Oh. So your first, like, human character.
Human character that I got to play. However, I got interested in performance and in visual arts early. And I knew that I wanted to pursue those and do those. I knew I wanted to draw professionally early.
Yeah.
But I didn't know what that really meant. And so I did my year and a half or so at a tool and die shop doing front wheel drive transmission casings and those kinds of things. So I understand the mechanical sorts of drawing, but they never really satisfied me the way that storytelling drawing does. So I kept going at that.
And that early exposure has led you down so many different paths,
it's
right?
True. It's true.
From graphic artist to cartoonist to performer in a variety of different ways. Talk a little bit about the comic strip for those who may not be familiar that you're the man behind Wild Woods and Paint My Monster too.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, there's a span there. I was approaching 30 years old and I was having a conversation with a dear friend of mine. I said, and I was doing graphic design at a place. And that, you know, if you get good enough at things, you can win awards, but I don't really care about awards so much as the fulfillment of the, I'm pretty proud of that piece. That's a nice piece of that. So I was doing graphic design, but also I was working with some sort of regional clientele, and it's not quite as free as I want to tell my own stuff. And I was telling a dear friend of mine, I feel like I have a Corvette engine and they're keeping me in the garage.
Mm.
And he said, you know, he said, I think you could think about syndicated cartooning, but you are going to have to learn how to write because you don't know how to write your way out of a paper bag.
Whoa, real.
Well, you know, that's why he was a friend.
Wow.
Like, you know, and he was right. And so like, okay. So I began to write. I did my first, this is a good story, I think, because it's a great story of failure. I did my first cartoon strip of, there were, at the time, there were only four syndicates in the country that will read your cold submission. Maybe there were seven, but four that really counted. And you have to send them 6 weeks worth of work. So it's Monday through Saturday.
Yeah.
They don't want to see a colored thing from you yet. A Sunday strip. So you send away your 36 strips as the development of, it's sort of the pilot of what you're doing, but there's no money or anything like that involved. There's no earnest money. There's no nothing. You're doing it cold and here you go. And I did what at the time were what I thought was, these are the nicest drawings that I have. And this is the first shot out of the gate at writing. And I got form letter rejections back from all the syndicates. They don't critique your work. You don't know what's good.
Wow.
You don't know what's bad. You don't know anything about it other than the line, this is not right for our syndication purposes for right now. And I had sent away for their one sheet on what they want to see. And yeah. I thought I was following that.
You thought you nailed it.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So like, okay. And it angered me because like, I got no critique back from these folks. What am I going to do? A couple of things cascade simultaneously that really were helpful. One was the idea that I'm going to let go of thinking about the audience first. Just completely let that go. I'm going to entertain myself as a primary idea of who this needs to entertain. Because if it's not funny to me, it doesn't matter if it's not funny to you, because how do I know if I scored anything? You know?
Yeah.
Make it funny. So the audience is not outside of the consideration, but they shouldn't be the first consideration. So
that's really interesting.
Let go.
Because I think so many people think the other way. But
I
love the idea of I'm going to entertain. I'm going to, you know, myself first. I'm doing this for myself first. That's
Dr. great. Dr. Seuss said, if my work doesn't surprise me, how do I expect it to surprise an audience?
Nice.
Well, I think so too.
Yeah.
So the other thing that came at that was I heard a lecture given by a guy named C.F. Payne, who's an illustrator that has done national covers of all kinds of things, TV Guide and Sports Illustrated. Mm-hmm. And he said that if all the painters that he knew who had reached the top of the illustration game could recite the history of painting just by rote and could distinguish between Hans Holbein the younger and Hans Holbein the greater in the brushstroke. He said they knew the history of what they were after. And if you don't know the history of your creative enterprise, your work is going to be stunted.
Hmm.
Like, oh, that's really a great thought. So immediately I began to look at the American newspaper strip cartooning history because
wow.
I didn't know that.
Yep.
When I want to be syndicated, but I really can't tell you anything about who the greats were or what they were exploring or anything like that. So that began to be the education. And within a few months, saw a difference in my work. So the anger at not getting a good critique plus the, I'm going to do something that I want.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I'm going to do the dumbest thing I can think of. And they have to read it because they're going to read it. And the history of what cartooning was in newspaper strips, because that's gag cartooning. And,
yeah.
you know, one of those differences that happened from its inception to how it had – what it became is before television, you could tell a narrative that would link Monday to Tuesday to Wednesday to Thursday and sort of tell an overarching tale where your protagonist can change over time. But the strips really dovetailed in a telling, like Terry and the Pirates was one of those. It's a soap opera,
yeah.
basically,
yeah.
a graphic soap opera.
Yep.
Well, today, nobody's really watching the cartoons like that. Like every one of your jokes has to stand on its own.
Right.
And you can't do a cliffhanger because nobody cares.
Mm.
They flushed that now. They can get that faster if
yeah.
they listen to radio or listen to the television. So it now has to be gag cartooning. So,
yeah.
okay.
Immediate.
Right, exactly.
Laughs,
exactly.
Immediate. Whatever reaction you want.
They can have
immediate. Yeah.
themes from week to week if
yeah.
you want. Jim Davis has done this with Garfield a number of times. Like maybe this week's all about spiders. And great. You know, that's a fun
yes.
thing to go mine for where your jokes are going to come from. But regardless, I was driving home from a graphic design job thinking, okay, I'm going to do my second cartoon strip here. I'm flushing all of those first ideas and I'm going to do the dumbest idea I have, which is it's going to be a bear that rides a tricycle in a circle. That's all that's going to happen. No dialogue. It's a pantomime strip and he's just going to ride a tricycle. That's it. And you know, in my own mind, I'm thinking every one of these is a big middle finger. Every one of these cartoons, this is great. And I got about 14 into the 36 that you have to make, and I started to care. I wanted to know what was going to happen next.
Oh, you cared about the bear.
Yeah. I things happened. What's,
yes.
oh, how nice. So finished those off, and that got me a phone call and eventually a developmental deal and the dealing with the senior editor of King Feature Syndicate.
Nice.
And eventually to being, they launched the strip. It was called Bobo's Progress initially.
Yes.
And music will come back into this because they were a band initially.
Oh,
Bobo was a musician, and so were the other two people the other two animals, anthropomorphized animals, that he was with. There was a bear, a rabbit, and a penguin.
Yes.
But anyway, so they were a band initially before Bobo became a pastor. 2 years down the road. But regardless of that, that was the initial to me. And I, the strip ran for about 5 years. And yeah. I think at our zenith, we were in about 80 papers.
That's awesome.
It was fun. And it taught me, it taught me a lot. We went from there to, I had a guy contact me that I had done some early illustration work for, and I still work with him. He's a dear, dear friend. And another creative professional, Dave Ponce. We started to do some work for the people who created CitraSolve, which is a dilimonene-based cleaner, and they wanted to spend some of their marketing money on a cartoon strip. And he said, "It's Russell the Leaf is going to be this. Would you? Are you interested?" "No." "No, I've already cartooned. I don't want to do it." Like, "I didn't know you were syndicated. I think you're perfect for this. Please," like, "I'm like, well, let's have dinner and we'll talk about everything that you guys have made up." And like, I sort of poo-pooed everything that he showed me. I was like, "You guys don't have any idea who these people are. Like, this is bad work and here's why." They're like, "You're perfect for this. Please come and do this." And they kept increasing the money. And finally I said, "Okay." So like, sure, I'll come and do that now, which was nice. So I was doing a cartoon strip with Dave Ponce for 3.5 years and we were doing educational material. Mm-hmm. And it was all... it was an environmentally themed strip. That's the whole of the thing was. Mm-hmm. So we were about, I don't know, a year and a half into doing that when the people footing the bill said, "Would you consider doing animation?" I'm like, "Yeah, sure. Sure. I'll start animating Russell the Leaf." So I made a few, and they're still on YouTube. You can, you know, YouTube search Russell the Leaf and you'll find some of those little animated things that I made. Yeah. And I was hand drawing them and I taught myself to use Flash and did that. And the moment I saw my own work move, went, "Why did I wait so long for this?" Because you can get to an emotional state in your audience that static graphic work, it's harder to get to the emotion of a person in the audience. So anyway, it was fun to watch the work move. I did a few animation projects and then that gig went away. And I freelanced for maybe a couple of months. And Dave called me back and we began doing work for Wings, et cetera. I was initially doing some static illustration for them. Mm-hmm. And then Wings, et cetera, had done some, I think they had 15 locations when I started doing work with them. They have 81 now in 13 states. And they came to Dave and said, "We got our first volley of television back from our local television commercial creators and we don't like it. It's sort of boring. They show a food, they show an interior, they show a price, they show a food, an interior, a price. What can we do? What can you guys do?" So Dave calls me, what can we do? I'm like, I don't know. What do you want to do? Let's sit. So we ate their food and talked about it for 3 days or so. And I said, "Listen, this is what I want. Like, what do I want to see if we're going to advertise for Wings, et cetera?" I said, "I want a couple of hillbilly chickens sitting at the bar complaining about life, smoking cigarettes and drinking beer. That's what I want. You can talk about food if you want, but all I want is a couple of guys sitting at a bar just complaining because that's what people do in a bar."
Yeah.
You know, there's a great old line from that movie Harvey that Jimmy Stewart says, "Nobody brings anything small into a bar," you know, which I adore that line. Like, okay, all they're going to do is complain and talk about their life and that's it. And he goes, "I love it. Where are we going to get the chickens? Are you thinking animation?" And I said, "Well, good Lord, no, that's too labor intensive. How about puppetry?" And he goes, "Where are we going to get the puppets?" And I was like, "Well, I went to art school. Pretty sure I can build TV pretty puppets." So my wife and I, who's been on the show, Carrie Wright of Carrie Wright Silk has been on the show. We built those puppets in the living room and I have been performing and doing editing work with those puppets ever since.
I love that.
Yeah, I do too. I do too.
It seems to me though, Dan, that you know, as you've gone on this journey and you've done a million things, many of which we can't even get to in this interview in the time we have, but it seems like it's about the learning for you. It seems like you like to learn new things. You like to experience new things. You like to be like, "Well, that seems like a challenge. I'm going to get there. I'm going to take that on." And I find, because I've seen you many times at open mics where you perform, which I love. It just seems like it's about the learning and the process and the doing that really fuels you.
It's the very primary hobby of my life. Yeah. I love to learn. I have several hobbies and I'm blessed tremendously to have the freedom to indulge them, to learn things. But truly, Michelle, learning is the primary. I love to learn things. And I think it came early with graphic design. Like I can talk myself into being interested into anything. And you know, people are always the most interesting things in the room. So I love and I also, because these are the days of the internet,
yeah,
you can now ask, what do the experts know? Mm-hmm. And how can, what are they talking about? So I love how fast you can use the information appliance and get to the, what the smart people know about it. And, and another part of it to me is if I had gotten really, really good at any one thing, I think maybe I would have stayed there to do that one thing over and over. And like, I get good enough, and like, it's not that I get bored of a thing. It's like I incorporate a thing into how I will use that to go make something up.
Do something else. Right. Yeah, exactly.
Right, 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 right. Exactly. Right. And well, one fuels another. So.
Yeah, exactly. Well, speaking of something else, please indulge us with a little tune before you go, will ya?
All right. This is an original song.
Perfect.
Okay. And I like, I,
with all the naughty words sticking out.
No, I didn't there's no naughty words. Okay. In this. There, I promise there's no naughty words. In this. All right. I wrote this year because of this songwriting group that you and I are part of, but this is not a true story. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Here's the song. Eddie Hinger is the kid who bit my finger back in the first grade. I saw him today. He's not doing okay. He said his marriage is over, that his wife up and left him last Saturday. It's a hellscape for Eddie Hinger, and that's okay. Why did he bite me? He said he was just a-seeing what would happen. It made me angry, that's what happened. I bet he bit his wife. People don't really like it when you haul off and bite them, even if you don't break the skin. I need to say it again. Eddie Hinger is a biter, and the single life is probably a little better for him. Keep your teeth to yourself, Eddie Hinger.
Thank you. Yeah, that's awesome. Thank you. And people may get to hear that live and in person, because you're going to be busking this summer.
That's right.
Aren't you? That's, as part of First Thursdays.
I will be out somewhere in Muncie on First Thursdays. Like I'm scheduled to do it on July and August. I'll be at Cornerstone busking, but like I'm not really tied to their schedule. Like, no, First Thursday, go find a place and go be somewhere and go play some music. So
I love that. Yeah, well, we'll see you on the street corner.
Thank you. Thank you.
Dan Wright, thank you so much for joining us in the studio. Really
Michelle
had a blast.
And Pop of Culture, what a fun. Like this could be part one of multi parts of we could have all kinds of fun. Thanks so much for having me. What a treat. Thank you.
Dan Wright is, among many other things, the cartoonist behind the comic strip Wildwood. It's the last segment of Pop of Culture for this week. I'm Michelle Kinsey.
And I'm Jen Blackmer. Instead of our usual What Are You Working On segment, today we have a visit with writer H.K. Hummel as part of our ongoing series of micro essays entitled Beautiful Things. H.K. is joining us from Little Rock, Arkansas. Is that correct?
Yes, I am. Thank you for having me.
We're happy to be here with you today. And HK is going to share with us your beautiful thing entitled, It Seemed Like Everything Was Still Before Us.
It seemed like everything was still before us. I crack an egg against the edge of the bowl while thinking about the bistro I worked in when I was 19. I wore corduroy pants, Doc Martin Mary Janes, and hand-sewn peasant blouses. I wrote poems on the order pad I kept tucked in my apron. I liked stepping out into the hot night and bicycling home under the streetlights. While students loitered over their books at the cafe tables, a boy named Adam taught me how to spin the batter on the griddle. While I practiced, he slouched against the counter and talked about his role in a streetcar named Desire. For weeks, I spun crepes in my dreams. I perfected the flip and fold, learned the menu on the sly, neatly plated the Coq au Vin Blanc. The manager discovered what I could do and made me a cook. That spring, the restaurant clamored with life. Ruddy-cheeked Joe sang madrigals as he wiped counters. Olivia, a punk with hair as black as motor oil, would snort and roll her smoky eyes at the boys. Everyone had someone to be. Now, I slide a crepe in front of my daughter and remember a dawn morning sugared with the scent of pastry and a single kiss. There was something simple about the way we lived. If we were hungry, we ate. If we wanted something sweeter, we made it sweeter.
That was It Seemed Like Everything Was Still Before Us. HK, thank you so much. That is lovely. What a lovely piece of remembrance and capturing a moment in time. Can you tell us what inspired this piece?
This essay is based on one spring when I was young. I think I was 19 or 20. And I think it was, you know, sort of maybe both springs mushed into one.
In my mind. And that is an age, definitely, isn't it?
So I was just thinking about who I was then and how it's not so different from who I am now, but also quite different in some ways.
Yeah. And that all of us contain both who we are now and who we were then, right?
Yes, absolutely.
There's the line that really jumps out at me and sort of, you know, causes that lovely punch in the gut for me is everyone had someone to be, right? Mm-hmm. It's not the usual thing we hear, everyone had somewhere to be. This is everyone had someone to be, right? So this idea of thinking about our future selves and who we think we're going to be, who we want to be, and how that then infuses our remembrance, right?
Definitely. I think what also was just amazing was that, you know, we all were so emphatically ourselves. And yeah. I knew it at the time and I can still see it now, mm-hmm. just how much we had just embraced who we were, even if it was only, you know, like having a glimmer of what that the potential for that was. Like we were completely and utterly ourselves. And that was wonderful.
Yeah. The imagery in particular of the Doc Martin Mary Janes, the hand-sewn peasant blouses, and then your friend Olivia, who was punk rock. That, I thought actually specifically of people I knew back then, very similar, as well as my own self sort of in that melange of expression, right? Figuring out who you are through not only the people you're with, but also some of the choices you make in your life.
I
also love the idea that you are sharing this with your daughter, right? As you make a crepe, as you put it in front of her and think about who you were then, that also resonates with me deeply as a parent, right? The sort of strange combination of wanting your kids to see you as a parent, but also the fact that you're a human being, right?
Yeah. Well, I think the funny thing was, I'm sure that particular breakfast was unremarkable. Sorry,
right,
it was just
yeah.
normal breakfast. But in my mind, you know, my mind was sort of time traveling as I was making breakfast.
Yeah, and that's just perfectly captured in this essay, in this short essay, with a beautiful specificity. And just a moment in time, which is great. Do you know about anything that happened to any of these folks that you spent time with those springs?
No. I wish I did.
But, yeah.
It was a long time ago, so I've lost contact with all of them.
Of course. Yeah. And I think about that too, a lot of, you know, the travels that I had as a early, you know, in my early 20s, and a lot of the peoples I encountered, a lot of the folks I encountered. And in this time, what's so interesting is it's much easier to keep in touch with people, right? And yes. I know that my own kids, for example, are in touch with so many different people that they've met over the course of their lives. And yeah. I'm curious how that is going to evolve for them as they get older.
It's a really interesting question. Yeah, I think that's partly just so generational that, you know, like, you know, I didn't have a cell phone when I was
right.
in college.
Yeah.
I had barely had email at that time, right? And so it was just a completely different sort of reality, I think.
Yeah. Well, what a gorgeous way to spend some time thinking about this moment in your life and how it I think inspires all of our listeners to think about times when it might have been, as you say, unremarkable, but really those moments as they come together to form a life are what are in fact remarkable.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, HK. I so much appreciate your time with us today and your beautiful thing. HK Hummel is a writer in Little Rock, the author of Lessons in Breathing Underwater, and the forthcoming second edition of Short Form Creative Writing. And we're so grateful for your time today. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
You too. This story comes from IPR's collaboration with River Teeth's Beautiful Things, a weekly magazine of micro essays. More at riverteethjournal.com.
Jen, it's time for the arts calendar. So much to do.
So much to see.
Let's get right into it.
All right.
The Muncie Three Trails concert featuring the Harlem Gospel Travelers is Friday, June 13th at Cornerstone Center for the Arts in downtown Muncie. The concert begins at 7 with local band Doc Peterson and the Little Chicago Band.
Indie Pride is this weekend at various locations around Indianapolis. The festival is Saturday and Sunday, June 14th and 15th, and includes the massive Indie Pride Parade at 10 a.m. Saturday down Mass Ave. The Word of Mouth Music Series at Military Park is both days from 2 to 10 p.m.
Goodnight Forest is now open at Minnetrista Museum and Gardens. Visitors will feel like they are stepping into a beloved children's storybook as they encounter whimsical scenes and engaging sensory activities in this nature-inspired experience. Minnetrista.net has more details. Oh, and Minnetrista will have its first evening hours event of the season at 5 p.m. Friday, June 13th.
Two completely different shows
yes.
are taking the stages at Muncie Civic Theater this weekend. This is your last chance to catch High Fidelity with shows through Saturday, June 14th in the Studio Theater. Based on the book by Nick Hornby and the movie starring John Cusack and Jack Black, this musical explores love, heartbreak, and the power of the perfect soundtrack. Filled with 90s nostalgia, this immersive experience also allows you to shop the set, shopping for
love
records
it.
Before the show and during intermission.
I love it.
On the main stage, we have 1776, which starts Friday, June 13th and runs through June 29th. The Tony-winning musical explores the events leading up to the signing of the Declaration of Independence, capturing the political struggles, debates, and personalities behind America's founding. More about both shows can be found at MuncieCivic.org.
The 6th annual Juneteenth celebration is Saturday, June 14th at McCulloch Park in Muncie. The event, open to all, is 2 to 9 p.m. and includes booths, games, live music, and so much more.
The 2025 Anderson On Tap Festival is Saturday, June 14th in downtown Anderson. The beer and other tasty beverages start flowing at 1 p.m. and do not stop until 5 p.m. AndersonOnTap.com is the place to go for more info.
The Indiana State Museum and all Indiana historical sites are open to the public, no tickets required, for Juneteenth, June 19th.
And don't forget Dad on Sunday, June 15th. It's Father's Day.
Indeed. If you have an event Pop of Culture listeners would love, let us know at indianapublicradio.org/contact. Then click Pop of Culture.
Support for Pop of Culture comes from the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, and from you. Become a sustaining member of IPR and support local programming today at indianapublicradio.org.
And that's our show. Our general manager is Phil Hoffman, and our producer is Luke Jones, our very own Renaissance man. Our show was hosted by me, Michelle Kinsey.
And me, Jen Blackmer. Thanks this week to Sean Ashcraft, Larry Beck, and Stephanie Weekman. Pop of Culture is a production that takes everyone from the team at IPR on the campus of Ball State University.
Can I get a quick mic check?
The test check, 1-2, big bats up to 155, down cross, over, up the thing, no.
That's the best mic check we've ever had. Ever.
All right. I think I'm going to find out. Go ahead.